You're listening to Packers Talk Network.
Do you want to experience the thrill of a Packers game at Lambeau Field? If so, be sure to get your game tickets from the longtime trusted source in Wisconsin, Ticket King. Visit their locations in Milwaukee and Green Bay, or just go to their website, theticketking.com. Again, that's theticketking.com.
Hi, this is Jerry Kramer, and you're listening to The Sweep.
Oh, I have sizzle.
All right, here we go, fellas. Let's have a little fun today.
What is going on, Pack Nation? Welcome back to another episode of The Sweep. I am your host, as always, Fred Thurston, and I will be flying solo today. But not completely solo, as we have a very special guest. Mr. Glenn Derby is joining us to talk about his struggles and triumphs throughout his life, from early childhood through his collegiate and professional NFL career, and the things that he went through and struggling with addiction and how he was able to overcome them and become the amazing power life coach that he is today. So I am super excited to be able to share his story with all of you and to hear it again for myself. So make sure you guys stick around and tune in for an awesome, awesome interview. All right, welcome back, Packer Nation. We are here with Glenn Derby, an inspirational guy that I have gotten to very little meet, and I'm excited to meet a little bit more. Someone that I friended on some social media sites through football and got to see a little bit more about him and his story, and have just been completely enamored with it. And so I'm more than honored to have him on our show to tell his story. Glenn, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. I really am honored as well. And it's been kind of a unique and a interesting and amazing that these last few years I've started to do some of the social media stuff and have been able to reach people that I never thought I would be able to. And the fact that you were able to hear me and want me to come on here just basically blows me away.
This is an incredible story that you have of your life and all the different things you've gone through and the triumphs. I think everyone in their own right has always kind of gone through their own things. Hearing from other people is so exciting. Your sobriety, your battle through addiction, I have battled through it myself. I've learned through time, too, that being able to express it and tell people my story is one of my favorite things to do, which is something that's so weird because for so long it was something that I hid from and that I tried to keep on the down low, if you will. And now it's something that through time I was able to really embrace and kind of tell people more about. So I'll kind of interject throughout the time with my own little situations as well. But I'm excited to hear about your story, where it all started, your childhood to playing football, being at UW, that's one of my places. I can't wait to hear about that. So just kind of let us know, first and foremost, where we can find you, where the listeners can find you, if they do need to reach out or want to reach out and talk to you at some point.
Yes, thank you. And the best way to reach out to me would be go to our site, the business that we are currently in running. And when I say we, my partner, Steve Stark, who is also a former Wisconsin Badger, he and I started a company called Trench Training, and it's, as it sounds, trenchtraining.com. You can find us there, and my phone number's there, and I'm always, always willing. It's been very interesting since I did a fellow teammates of mine podcast. We actually did it back in, I think, November, but he just aired it in March, and since then, I've had at least a dozen people reach out to me. Three of which who have decided to change their lives based on what my story was. So, you know, we all think, and I can remember when I was a kid thinking, you know, that I was unique or I was different. in a lot of ways. One of the reasons was is because I was very tall at a very early age. You know, my dad, he was tall, not super tall, and my mom's not super tall, but for whatever reason, I got the gene of being tall, and I was tall early. So in every class that I was in, everywhere I went, I was always kind of a standout, different kind of a kid, and you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, our lives are what our lives were, and my parents moved around a lot, so I didn't go to the same school every year. I went from, you know, I was born in North Carolina. My dad was playing football at Duke. He injured his knee. You know, and I never did get the chance to actually ask him this, and I wish I would have, but I don't know why he decided to leave Duke from football. I don't know if it was because he was injured, he couldn't stay on the team anymore, or he just decided to leave. I don't know that, but for whatever reason, we left. And we went to Arlington, Texas, where my dad was working there, and you know, I had my first four and a half years of my life was at Arlington, Texas, where I obviously started to become a huge Dallas Cowboy fan. Back when Bart Starr, Walt Garrison, you know, Tom Landry, those guys, and I just loved the Cowboys. So that was my first thought into football, and my dad ran a business, and the business failed, and he and my mom decided that they wanted to become ranchers. So we ended up moving right at, I don't remember if it was in the middle of my kindergarten year or right after my kindergarten year, but, or it might even been my first grade, but whatever year it was, we moved early, and we moved to Wyoming, where my dad became a ranch hand, and we started living kind of like back in the old days, you know, in the old Western deals. We stayed in a small little house out on a ranch. And so I started running around, you know, working with cows, working with, you know, hay and horses, and doing ranch stuff. And what a great place for a kid to get into all kinds of trouble and have a lot of fun. And I did. I had a lot of fun. You know, but the problem was, is that he wasn't in a stable environment, so we kept moving. So we moved a half a dozen times between the time I was a kindergartner till I was in eighth grade. We went, they decided to go to Montana State to go back to school to get degrees in different fields. And there I became a Montana State Bobcat, Montana State Bobcat fan, and watched college football there. So I really loved the game of football as a fan. I started playing it because obviously all kids want, not all, but most kids want to play football. I didn't like it. I did it because of it was mainly because of the stuff that I'd watched on TV, and I wanted to be like those guys, and I played it. Well, when you're a big, tall kid at a young age, you know, I was pretty coordinated. I mean, more so than some other big kids, but I wasn't as coordinated, obviously, as the little kids. And it was a very difficult game for me to play. And my dad was pushing me real hard to be a player. You know, obviously society, every time you meet a new teacher or someone, they're like, oh, you should play football or basketball, you know, 'cause I was tall. So I got both, and I loved basketball. So I played a lot of that, played a lot of football. And in that time frame, partly because I moved around a lot, partly because of this is the way it was out in, we had left Wyoming and ended up in Montana. I'm out in Montana, and they, you know, you grow up a lot faster out there. You're able to drive tractors. You're able to drive pickups on the gravel roads. You're able to ride motorcycles, all that kind of stuff you're able to do because you're out in the, you know, it's some houses are a mile apart or more. And in order for the kids out there, you know, and the families to survive, the kids have to work. And even though, you know, my dad had gone to school, and I didn't say this, but he had become a school teacher. So we moved back to a place called Red Lodge where he was a school teacher. So we weren't ranchers, but he was a teacher, and we were living in Montana, and I was ranching. I started driving. I started, out there, you can get your license, you'd get your driver's license at the age of 15, so you get your learner's permit at 14, and you're allowed to drive, I think, at 13 on gravel roads if you're doing farm business. So if you have a pickup full of hay, you're legally allowed to drive on a gravel road. You can cross a paved road, but you can't drive on it, but you can drive on the gravel road. So you grow up really fast. And one of the things that happened back then is there was a lot of freedom. You were free to do whatever you wanted to do. And in that freedom, I started to do some experimenting. And I rodeoed, I rode bulls, I rode broncs, I roped, team roped, did all that kind of stuff. So I was very, very active, very busy. And one of the things that happened in there is you hang out with older kids, you hang out with older people, and I got exposed to alcohol at a very early age. I still remember this to this day, and I know exactly where I was, I know exactly who I was with, and we drank a six pack of warm beer that was in my parents' basement. And obviously warm beer is not the most appetizing, but we thought it was cool. So he and I drank, we each had three beers, and we basically forced each other to drink them. But I remember this feeling today. I can remember the feeling of that warmth of what the alcohol did to my body. And I remember thinking, this is what I want. I want to feel like this. This is how I want to feel. And so from then on, and I think I was 13, maybe. I don't think I was quite 14 yet. So it was a pretty young age. And I've got a 13-year-old daughter right now, and I can't even imagine her. You know, she's such a wonderful kid, and you know, I see her all the time, and I just can't even imagine her thinking that it would be cool to do this. I did. And it was partly the environment, partly, you know, I think the way I was raised. And it was also the time frame. It was different back then. People, there was not the internet. There was not the education of all the different problems. So I go to start drinking, and that becomes my obsession. Go through sports. I was very good at it. Was very blessed. I worked hard. I think, you know, some of it was God-given, and some of it was hard work, and some of it was the fact that I really just found the couple things that I enjoyed. I didn't like school. I didn't like doing that, but I loved doing athletics, and I loved partying. So my dad decided out there that he was going to become an Episcopal priest. Well, you know, that's kind of a shocking thing when you're a freshman in high school and you've finally been in a school long enough that you have some really good friends and you're really established and you're doing really well athletically and people really like what you're doing, et cetera, et cetera. And then all of a sudden your dad out of the blue is like, all right, we're going to move again. And he chose to move to Wisconsin because there was a seminary there at Neshota where that's where he wanted to go because in his mind, that was what was most like Montana. And I know what he was saying. It's, you know, Neshota is better than Berkeley, California, but at the same time, Wisconsin is nothing like Montana. So,
no.
You know, and you're moving out here at the age of 15, leaving all your friends. I had a girl that I really, really liked at the time. And, you know, I remember driving away from there, just bawling my eyes out, thinking my life was ruined. Come to Wisconsin in a totally different environment, go to a school. In Montana, our graduating class, I think there were 36 kids in it. When I go to Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, which is at that, you know, that's funny too. How do you say Oconomowoc?
Right.
So yeah, I go there and my class there was like 400 kids in it.
Yeah, there's usually about 36 kids in each class.
Exactly.
Like literal class.
Yeah. So I'm coming out here and I'm like, you know, wow, what the heck, you know, I'm just in survival mode, I guess. And well, so I come to Wisconsin at the age of, it was in June, so I just turned 16, and it was very easy for me to switch over my license because all I had to do was go to DMV and show them that I had my Montana's driver's license. So I didn't have to do the driver's ed and all that. I just got my license at 16. So I'm the first kid right before our sophomore year. I have a pickup already, and I've got my license.
That's a dangerous state.
Talk about a recipe of disaster. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I always, my son is a September baby.
Okay.
And he will be most likely one of the first few that get his license from his grade. And I actually had talked to him not too long ago about how you will probably get a lot of new friends
right
around that age time, around 15 to 16, because you will be the one who everyone wants to get a ride from. And in my own experience, I was the second youngest. So I had to wait a very long time.
Okay.
But my best buddy at the time was the first one to get his license. And drinking was a part at that time in my life. We were drinking, but I remember very vividly how that's when we started to smoke cigarettes.
Okay.
Because we could just get in the car and go. And that was like our rebellious kind of moment that we had around 16. I was going to say that prior to that, I was around the same age when I started as well. Total because of environment, being that my family and grandparent or Grandpa Fuzzy had his bar, and that's usually where we congregated. So it was one of those things where that's a day-to-day thing. That was what we did. That's what I thought was so normal, was you drank and then you did this. And then when you found out that, oh, this beverage right here can make me feel warm and fuzzy and take away all the bad stuff, you start to really realize, well, that's a good deal. I'm going to keep going with that. So, I hear you on the being 16 and that. I mean, I can only imagine coming in. You're going from a place of drinking to a place of serious drinking in Wisconsin.
Yeah, you know, I think to this day, you know, living here now for 30 some years, I have lived in other places and I have seen, you know, seen communities that is not wrapped up in the drinking. Wisconsin is a little bit unique, and you know, the funny thing is I get drafted by the New Orleans Saints, and New Orleans has kind of got some similar characteristics of Wisconsin in that they absolutely love their party life. And you go to other states, there's two or three taverns or nightclubs in a town. You go to Wisconsin, they're on every other block.
Yes.
And they've got people in them during the day that, you know,
People get out of shifts in the morning.
Yeah, there's bars. My first wife was she had worked for the Miller Company as a model, and I remember her getting up on Sunday mornings at like 4:30 or 5 to go to a tavern where they were doing a promotion. I'm like, really? How busy is the tavern in Wisconsin at 5 o'clock? Well, the third shift workers get off and they come in there, and I went and saw her a couple times, and it was as full as it is in the evenings. It's just amazing to me.
You know, we were just in vacation in Alabama, and my son and I were walking down the aisle, the beer aisle, which was connected to the chip aisle, conveniently.
Sure.
And an older man came up to us and was like, "Hey, do they sell liquor in Alabama on Sunday?" And I was like, I don't know. And my son looked at me and was like, "Dad, could you imagine if they didn't sell beer on Sundays for Packer games?" Yeah. I was like, wow. I know, but that's you. It's equated, and it's, he's actually, I really no issue with and no worry about, because he's seen the things. But it is something that is just, it's so culturally just accepted here and there and everywhere in Wisconsin. But it's also not our staple. It's not who we are, and I think that kind of gets confused sometimes. But we do in Wisconsin like to drink. We have lots of breweries and we have lots of good sports and stuff, but it is a little different than in other places. When I lived in Florida after high school as well, I was talking to somebody and we went to, I believe like a baseball game or something like that. And I was like, "Oh, you guys want to tailgate?" And they didn't even know what tailgating was.
Right.
They had no idea. They're like, "Wait a minute, you just go and sit outside the stadium and drink?" And I was like,
"Yeah,
shoot, we'll find any reason to go drink."
Sure. And I don't like to come across to people that I'm, you know, completely anti-drinking. I think there's a definite issue in our society with the acceptance of alcohol abuse, and, you know, obviously drinking and driving and drinking at work. And, you know, there are many, many people out there, and I know people that are like this, that are totally fine going out and having a few drinks and loosening up and enjoying themselves. There's those of us who can't do that. And, you know, I really, you know, it's in sharing the story, I share a lot of my experiences and hoping that people will relate to or say, "Oh my gosh, I felt the same way and I did the same thing," so that then they can make the choice, you know, have the option of making a choice of, you know, there is a different way to live. You don't have to, You do not have to live in Wisconsin and go to the taverns and be, you know, a party animal. It's possible not to do that. And I know that firsthand because I've done it for over 24 years and I've got lots of friends that don't do it. And, you know, there's different ways you can live life. And in these podcasts, which is so cool, and you, your story and what you're doing, I just, it's awesome because, you know, your grandfather's legacy. I knew some of those guys. You know, when you go into training camp, a lot of times it was, you know, you got to be this tough, we're going to work our ass off and then we're going to go out and party our ass off and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And if you don't, you're a wimp and you ain't going to make it and blah, blah, blah. And you kind of fall into that mindset that I have to do this. Now, that's how some were. I was a little different. Mine was, I'm telling you, from that 13 or 14 years old, I was obsessed with that feeling. And it didn't matter what sport I was playing. It didn't matter what activity I was doing. I'm going to drink and I'm going to get drunk. And yeah. It wasn't a Wisconsin thing. It wasn't a Montana thing. It was, you know, I was an angry kid. I think a lot of, you know, I got picked on unmercifully for my size. I mean, you know, everywhere, and even today, everywhere I go, unfortunately, I'm totally cool with it now, but you know, you're spotted out. I mean, yeah. You know, my ex-wife used to get, she's like, Glenn, everywhere we go, somebody knows you. And I'm like, you know what? Same thing would happen to you if they could see you in the crowd. You know, if you're 5'10", 5'11", 6 foot, someone walks in, they're going to see a whole bunch of other people that are that height. Now I'm I'm 6 inches or more taller than most people. Obviously they're going to see me. And that's what I would tell her. It's not because I'm more popular than anyone else. It's because they can see me. And, you know, so I just think, you know, I want people to know that my story is something that I'm very willing to share. I'm very willing to help, you know, others that have had similar experiences. And I want to just send a message out there that, you know, my 53 years of living, I've gone through an unbelievable amount of crazy stuff. And, you know, when I turned 30, I got sober when I was 29 and I didn't know what to do. First of all, I never thought I would live past the age of 30. I thought 30 was as old as you can get. Yeah. I thought there is no life after 30.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, why would I get sober to live a life that I never thought was, you know, even a thought in my head. You know, I was so miserable from all the stuff that had happened. You know, football didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. Life basically just really sucked. And, you know, I was, again, now looking back on it, I was very blessed to have certain people show up in my life at those certain times to give me some hope and some direction on a different way to go. So football, you know, I absolutely love the game of football. I think it's something that teaches more life lessons and more life skills than any other sport out there. Yeah, do you learn it in basketball and baseball and track and gymnastics and volleyball and all that? Absolutely. But there's nothing that you can compare a training camp, a football training camp, other than maybe the military that you go through that is so demanding and so reliant on having to rely on others than training camps in football. I went through 17 of them. So I did learn a lot and did bring a lot of lessons into life.
Yeah. It's a something I talk to my kids about all the time. My 11-year-old is going through it right now. He's just starting into tackle and all that. And I tell him, cherish it, cherish yeah. every yeah. single second of it, cherish the sweat, cherish the tears, cherish the bum knees, because I mean, I would give it up, and I shouldn't say I'd give it up in a heartbeat to go back, but I definitely would like maybe another shot.
Oh, it would be fun to do it different, right?
For sure. And we've talked about, I mean, I talk about all the time on different regrets and things like that you have in your life, and that's inevitable. I think everyone has them. But in the same breath, then I'm not where I am right now, and where I am right now is perfect. And I wouldn't be here without them. So, you know, football is one of the big ones. School is another one that I always talk about with regrets with my older son. And you know, I tell him that if I could do it over, if I could have, you know, been more, applied myself more, as all my teachers would have said in high school.
Sure, sure.
You know, I probably could have done better. I could have played football maybe a little bit farther. I could have gone to a better school and all that stuff like that. I'm like, but then I wouldn't have probably stayed with mom. And then I wouldn't have known you. And I told him that. And he looked at me and he's like, Dad, I'm glad you made those mistakes. And I go,
yeah,
thanks. You know, yeah. Like that makes me feel good about it. But, you know, that's part of it. I went to UW. I lived in Madison for about 7 years, and I was not getting my doctorate. And to me, it is still my absolute favorite place in the world. I spent 7 years raging.
Okay. I don't
know if you use that word, but
yep,
it's kind of what it was. It was a 7-year stint of how much can I party? How much can I push the limit? I'll work a little bit. I'll maybe go to some classes, but for the most part, I'm going to go out with a bang. And yep. That was pretty much my plan. And it was a heck of a time. It was absolutely incredible. It also makes my stomach churn sometimes when I think about it. You were in Madison. You played. You know the culture, the environment, where you were at in your life at that time. That had to be super tough. Or well, super great. I mean, at the time, yeah. It was probably great. But looking back, it probably was the wrong combination.
Well, and I may be a little bit unique in this. I don't want to make myself unique to others. But, you know, not growing up in Wisconsin, other than the 3 years I went to high school. And to be honest with you, when I started, my dream was to play basketball. It was football too, but I loved playing basketball. So I'm at a high school, Oconomowoc High School, and I'm playing pretty well. I'm doing, you know, obviously I do well, well enough to get some accolades and that, but I'm getting in the recruiting process, and it's amazing to me today to look back at it and think about, I remember what were my thought processes were. There's like 40 or some schools or more that were interested in me, but I narrowed it down to 4 schools to go on a visit. Nebraska was one. Minnesota was one. Purdue was one. Wisconsin was one. And Clemson, or actually 5, Clemson was one. And I, at the time it was okay, Nebraska, because I was in Montana, and Nebraska was the college football that I watched mostly, other than the Montana State. And Nebraska at that time was a very, very good program.
Yeah.
Purdue was, I don't even know why I picked Purdue. I think it was because I thought their uniforms were cool.
They were the Boilermakers, maybe?
Or maybe the Boilermakers, yeah. And then Minnesota was because I wanted to see a big city, and I liked the Metrodome. I thought, oh, how cool would it be not to have to be out in the cold weather and play? And then, of course, Wisconsin. And I went to a couple of the visits, and I related – my decision came down to, and this is what's sad about it, is my whole decision came down to 2 things. One was my experience with whichever coach it was. I had a horrible experience with Coach Osborne. The coach for Purdue was cool, but he was on the hot seat, and I didn't know if he was going to be staying. The guy up in Minnesota, I can't remember his name. I don't even remember, you know, the conversation with him, because it was not a real sincere one. Dave McLean at Wisconsin was an incredibly sincere. He was a guy that I looked at, and I remember thinking, man, if I could have a different father, that would be one that I would want. He was just an amazing man. But then the second decision was the party. Nebraska, there was zero party. I didn't even go to a party. They said, you know, well, we don't really drink much out here, blah, blah. I'm like, I am not going here. And then I go to Purdue, and we have a great time. Now, here's a kid coming from Montana, goes to Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, who I've only met one. This is not in any way, I don't want it to come across wrong. I had not met a black person. I did not know any. I had never met one. So I didn't know anything about, you know, anything. And I go to Purdue, and they were like almost all black. I felt really uncomfortable there. We were at a party. We were having fun. But I didn't feel like I belonged, because right. I had not ever met any. And I didn't know the culture. They talked a little different, and the parties were, it was fun. But I'm like, I don't feel real comfortable. Minnesota was, you know, it's a big city. There was a cool party we went to, but Wisconsin was unbelievable. I mean, we go to this place and the party was, you go to State Street, you go to all that stuff. It's a unique experience compared to most colleges. My brother went to Iowa and I went down to visit down there. Now they had some really cool bars and they had some really cool fun, but it was nothing like Wisconsin. So between, you know, Dave McLean and the party, and that's why I chose Wisconsin, because I wasn't one of these kids in Wisconsin that grew up watching Wisconsin football. I went to my senior year in high school. I went to the Michigan, who was number one or number two in the nation. I got tickets from them up there to go to that. Me and three of my buddies, we go to this game because they're free tickets. We go into the stadium. We watch about 3 minutes of the first quarter, and we're like, screw this. Let's go to State Street. Back then, you could drink at 18, so I was legal to drink. So we just left, and we went to State Street and got hammered. Well, that was a game that Wisconsin beat Michigan as the number one team. It would have been the best game ever to see, and I didn't even watch it. I was not a Badger fan by any means. I mean, I knew who they were, but I was like, whatever. You know, it was mainly because of Dave McLean and the partying. So, but once I got there, you know, once I got there, yes, I was like you. I raged like crazy. There's probably more good times that I forgot than, you know, I could ever think. And it was a phenomenal experience. Probably looking back on it, it was, how can I put it? God had a plan, and this is the only way I can put it, is that God had a plan for me, because I got there, I was on scout team, and scout team, you know, is a place you don't want to be. You get the crap beat out of you. You run someone else's offense that you're not familiar with. You're basically a piece of meat. And I only wanted to get off scout team because it was bad. It wasn't like I was going, okay, I got to get up there so I can, you know, become a player. I just wanted to get off scout team. So I asked the coaches and they told me what to do. And they said, you know, you got to start playing lower. So I did. And I ended up getting off the scout team, and I was a backup player my freshman year. So the year I got redshirted, I actually traveled to every one of the games. That was super exciting. I mean, unbelievable. You go into Michigan, you go into Ohio State, you go into Iowa, you go into all these stadiums, and you go out on the field, you feel like you are just Superman. It is such an unbelievable feeling to have 70, 80, 90,000 people screaming, and you're out on the field, and they're all yelling your name or yelling at you or, you know, whatever. It's just an indescribable feeling. And that just boosted my desire to then become a player. And so then I started working my ass off, and I started getting in better shape. The problem that I had was, is because I was so – my whole life was so wrapped up in alcohol, I just continued that thing. I was one of those guys that drank heavily two or three nights a week. And Saturday nights after the game was blackout. I mean, I was just partying from the moment we were done till, you know, whatever. And I think I really think that I could have had a totally different experience. Now, my good friend and teammate, Paul Gruber, who obviously, if you know anything about Wisconsin football, he did phenomenal. He was drafted number four and played for the Tampa Bay for like 12 or so years. I very easily could have been the same thing him. After my junior year, I was projected to be the third tackle to go out, you know, to get drafted. After my sophomore year, Coach Dave McLean died. So I got to play for him 1 year, and then he died. Devastating. You know, when you talk about drinking and some of the things that we do with drinking, he was one of the guys that was actually one of the only guys that only coaches and only people at the university that actually mentioned to me and talked to me about, maybe I want to stop drinking. As he said, he had heard about, you know, how I was and how I partied and such. He goes, you know, Glenn, that may be something you want to look at. Nobody else said that. It was all normal. People thought everything I was doing was fine. I'm getting out of parties at 4:30 in the morning and going to 6 a.m. workouts, completely hammered. You know, none of the players said anything. You know, none of the coaches, like the weight coach, didn't come up and say, what the hell are you doing? It was just an accepted thing. So I think my life would have been totally different had somehow, and I'm not saying I would have listened, because I can give you another example. When I had an agent, he told me, Glenn, you know, if I could give you a pill with all the experiences that I've had with you guys and you would make the right decisions, he goes, this is what I would suggest you do. And he told me all these suggestions and I listened to him. I said, yeah, whatever. And I went and did my own thing. You know, I didn't have the ability, and I think it was mainly because I was so consumed with alcohol and wanting to party and wanting to feel good that I didn't care about anything else. I didn't care about longevity. I wasn't going to live past the age of 30. I didn't need to have any, you know, any plan after college. I just needed to get as hammered as I could and have as much fun as I could.
And that's, I think, one of the biggest problems, it was for me especially, was the normalcy of it. And yes, that became the normal. And being sober was the strange feeling. I thought for so long, for so many years, that that's who I had to be. That's what I needed to be. And if I wasn't drunk, then I wasn't ready.
You weren't accepted. Yeah.
Person. I wasn't. Yeah. I didn't know what I, right. I wasn't funny. I wasn't, no one wanted to hang out with me. I wasn't going to entertain the way I should. Cause I always was the life of the party or the, you know, right. or so I thought. That was the other thing that I came to conclusion with once I became right. sober was everybody laughing with me or at me the entire time? I don't know. But while I was drinking, I was damn sure they were all laughing with me.
Exactly. Yep.
But it probably was a big joke. I mean, you know, slobbering around and being right. you know, completely wasted was probably not the coolest thing for anyone else to see. But that became the normal. And that was something I struggled with for a long time when I chose to become sober was, will people still like me? Will I still be funny? Will I still be charismatic? Will still, you know, will people still accept me for who I am? And once I realized that I'm as funny as I was and maybe funnier, then it was like, oh, maybe that wasn't the whole thing.
Yep.
And then you start to realize how much it was just masking. And for you, from what I've heard, the moving coaches going or passing away, you know, all the different things that you'd went through already, recipe for drinking and drinking, because it's just easier to drown those feelings and to actually sometimes deal with them.
I think there's two things that I can equate to that. One is Paul, who, you know, obviously did very well. He had a very serious girlfriend and he would party with us occasionally, but it was very occasionally. And I look back on that particular thing and I wonder, man, you know, if I could have been like him and escaped the, as you said, and you said it very well, the normalcy of the party life, what would my life have been like? And then the other thing was when I was in New Orleans, my roommate, Joel Hilgenberg, I used to watch him and he hardly ever partied and he put his money away and he didn't do, you know, a lot of extravagant things. And I would just wonder in my mind, I'd go, how can he do this? I can't even fathom thinking how he could be making these mature decisions like that. And why can't I? And so yeah. then as soon as I'd say, why can't I? I'd say, oh, right, screw it. Then I may as well not even try. And I kind of had that defeatist attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And it started happening. You know, obviously, you know, one of the things is when you're projected as the third pick, the third tackle taken in the whole entire pick as a junior, and then you go in the eighth round in the after your senior year because, well, there's a lot of different reasons. But and I blamed everyone else.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, I had a big role in it, and I did. It was, I'm the reason I was picked in the eighth round and not a higher round. At the time, it was everyone else's fault. But, you know, when you have things like that happen. You don't know that it's the alcohol that's creating it. It's very difficult to see anything better. And so like Joel and Paul, they, you know, they could see a future. For me, all I could see was I've screwed up so bad. Why even bother?
Yeah.
So basically you spiral yourself down into this little hole that you don't know how to dig yourself out of and you're blaming everything else. And the only thing that makes you feel better is alcohol. Or, yes. You know, and for me, the pain medicine is what took me down to the lower levels where I hit a bottom so bad that I decided to change. But it's just really interesting now looking back on it to think, you know, alcohol can literally ruin people's lives and they don't even know it's being ruined.
Without a doubt. Your story of, I guess you could say, your own personal kind of failure, your thoughts of failure with your career. Not saying that you were, because you've accomplished way more than anyone else sitting in this room, but it is a strong leading factor to it, and it's a huge factor into why I started drinking, and it's also even a huge factor into why my dad was the same way. My dad went to UW, played for UW, and for us to never quite get to the pedestal that my grandpa was on,
right,
was always such a thing. And for my dad was way better than my grandpa was ever at football.
Right.
Was dominant, had offers from everywhere, ended up going to UW mostly because my grandpa wanted him to, was a star running back, all these sorts of things. And then just kind of, he had some knee issues and kind of just never quite lived to, I think, the status that I don't know if he put on himself or if everybody else put on him. But I know that he didn't quite get there. And where do you go from there? Where do you go as a person when you've completely underachieved from what everyone's standards or what everyone's thoughts were, and then you have to hide, you have to almost take yourself away, and you don't want to be around those people, you don't want people to see that, you don't want people to know that, so you hide it, and you bury yourself in alcohol, and those are the things that I know he went through, and similar even with myself too. But it's a slippery slope, and with alcohol came every other, you know, drug and thing to do. And that just, it was that constant chase to not feel and to be able to feel like you were feeling, but not feel, if that makes any sense in any way.
Absolutely. Sure. And I think the thing that the way I look at it is, and this may not be true for everyone, but I do believe this. There were times where I wanted to go live in the middle of the mountains with nobody and have nobody in my life. And there are people that try to do that, and I don't think there are very many that are successful, because whether we want to admit it or not, our makeup wants us to, you know, our genetic makeup or whatever you are, being humans, we desire and we need to be accepted and a part of something. And you look at all these kids, you know, you look at the serial killers or the murders or all these, you know, we call them wackos, whatever. Their main issue, if you look through their life, is that they didn't belong. They weren't part of. So yeah. when you're a football player or a basketball player or a musician or, a, you know, someone in school, whatever, when you're in your chosen, your chosen talent pool and you're trying to become something, and you know that you want to be the best at it because that's what we're made. You know, if you're competitive, you want to be the best. And when you inside instinctually, and you know that you could be the best, and you see people next to you that you're like, I know I'm as good, if not better than that guy. Why am I not going anywhere? It is really, it's very difficult to accept. And for me, when I got out, it was blame, 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 blame. You know, football is the dumbest thing. I'll never let my kid play football. You know, why would society ever want something as stupid as this game? You get to the NFL, it's nothing like what you see. It's on TV. It's nothing like your childhood dreams of it being. You know, well, it wasn't for me because I was so bitter, angry, and self-defeatist that I didn't have a good experience. Now, there's a lot of other guys that had great experiences. And I think it's that whole, as you said, you know, your dad wanted to be at a certain level. You wanted to be a certain level. I see fifth graders. I see third graders that want to be at a certain level. If you want to be there, nothing but getting there is going to be satisfactory to you. So, yes, I played in the league for 3 years. I feel like I was a failure, even to this day. And I know the statistics. I know everything that says, you know, at only 0.001 or whatever, ever even make it to that level. So I'm in a unique group. However, I know where I should have been. I know where I could have been. So for many, many years, that's what drove my self-esteem, my self-worth, and everything else. And the only thing I could do was get away, because otherwise I was gonna explode. You know, and I had to come to an acceptance and a realization that, you know what, being human, being a great guy, being a great father, being a great employee, being a great whatever, is as important and is as good as being an NFL football player. In the scheme of things in life, that's more than enough, and that's what we need to get for. And that's something that takes work and skill to learn, especially for an alcoholic, but for anybody, to be able to accept themselves for who they are as a good person is key. And I see, and I work with tons of ex-players who, you know, they it's very, very difficult for them to get to that point. They just can't accept the fact that they're not playing anymore. They can't accept the fact that they didn't get to where they wanted to be. It's not an easy thing. But for me, I'm very blessed that I did have the ability, and I have gotten to the point where now I'm incredibly grateful for the game. I think the fact that I did play has allowed me to work with kids and work with people and teach them things that I never, ever would have had that opportunity to do had I not went through that experience. So it's really a matter of attitude and how you look at, you know, how grateful you are and how you use these different things that we have. Like you know, you have had this ability to have this podcast and have this ability to reach out to hundreds and thousands of people to share a message. And it just blows me away. You know, this whole, when Mark asked me to do the podcast and when I started learning all this other stuff, it's really amazing how we can take something that we thought was so horrible and make it into a good thing.
Yeah, I love everything that I went through. Right. And I used to despise it and hide it and hate it and everything like that. And it wasn't until I got, you know, a little bit into my sobriety, and I'm still nowhere near 25 years, but I was able to quickly learn what my worth was and what my value was. And I told my wife this the other day, actually on the drive down to Alabama, that, you know, my entire life, I wasn't sure where I was supposed to be, what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to be the next great Thurston. I was supposed to do this. I was supposed to be this. I wasn't that. I drank. I, you know, self-medicated. And then eventually I became sober. And when I became sober, that's when I started the podcast. I started a small clothing line. I really kind of took everything and I wanted to do everything. And it was all there, and I still love it. I love doing this podcast. I love the clothing line. I love everything else. But it wasn't until I really kind of sat down and thought about it and realized that it's my kids. That is my ultimate yep. legacy. That is my complete mission in life, and that's what God has put me here for, was to be the best dad. And that is my job. Like, that is – my standards for that are so attainable and so real and so positive, and I love that feeling of knowing that that's my role, that's my job, is to be the greatest husband and father to my kids that I can be, and that's okay. That's good enough, and that's going to be just fine for me, and I can live a happy life with that. I don't need to be making $30 million a year playing quarterback for the Packers. Now, right. Would I love that more than you'd ever know?
Absolutely.
But in the same breath, I love that I get to inspire my children and teach my children and show them the ways of life the best that I can, and yep. try to guide them the best that I can, and also be able to walk a journey with my wife. And those are my favorite people. And those are the ones that matter. And for so long, I tried so hard to please everybody else. And it wasn't until, you know, my wife, who has been there since high school. So she has seen me in every phase of my chaos, and God bless her. But yep. she's been there since day one. And she was the one that would slap me in the face and was right there to wake me up and say, come on. And so for me to see where she is and her happiness with how we've become, that to me is a win. And that just negates everything that I quote unquote failed to do in my previous life, as I like to call it.
Yep. Yeah, I that you're absolutely correct. And it is about perspective. It's also about, you know, I think it comes down to, if you want to make it as simple as possible, I had gotten certified as a life coach and went through a whole lot of things about learning how to empower your emotions. And you go through all different kinds of things to try and help others. And the biggest thing is it comes down to balance and priorities.
Yes.
And when you're balanced and prioritized, right, you know, you've got, and this is just me. It's, you know, I'm not speaking for anyone else. This is me, but mine is, you know, God, myself, my family, my career. And I think the thing about it is, you know, if you put yourself before all of that, before your wife, before your kids, before everyone else, they're going to appreciate so much. They're going to in turn help you. And so many people get it backwards. They think, okay, if I can play in the NFL, I'll find a hot wife. Yeah. If I can, you know, if I can get a good career, make a ton of money, I'll have great kids.
Yeah.
You know, if I can become a great coach, I'll make enough money that my wife will stay with me. Or, you know, you get all these different backwards thinking, and it's really more about finding out who you are and who and what you're meant to be. And that's where you know, I hope that my message can be that you know, all of us. I bet you if somebody even asked Brett Favre, Brett probably would say that he could have been better, you know.
Oh, for sure.
And I can say at my level, I could have been better. But it doesn't matter. What matters is okay, what are we doing in life? What's our purpose in life? You know, Brett's obviously was to be a great quarterback for many, many years. You know, yours is you went through your experiences that you did, but you found out your purpose is to, you know, support and love a phenomenal family, and you get just as much joy out of it. And it may not be society's joy, but it's your joy. It's what you feel, you know, when you go to bed at night, you feel good that, wow, you know, I was able to overcome something that was an incredibly difficult, you know, to become sober. Only 10% of the, I think it's less than 10% of all the people that try to get sober ever do.
That's crazy.
And then those that do get sober, the percentage of them staying sober is like 2%. So, you know, you talk about getting to the NFL level, that's an incredible task. Getting sober is an incredible task for someone who's got an alcoholic problem or a drug problem. It is incredibly difficult. And we don't spend enough time as society. You know, we'll praise and scream and holler and say how great it is that someone's in remission from cancer. But many times people will look at you as weak because you have an alcohol problem and have to quit drinking.
Yeah.
And those are things that I think are misconceptions of our society that I think people like you, myself, others out there, that we can try and hopefully help change that conception for people. And to give them praise and say, you know, that is phenomenal that you're able to do that. And the fact that you're helping others and you're sharing a message to help others, it blows me away.
Yeah.
You know, and I would love to meet, I would have loved to have met your grandfather. I love meeting some of these guys that have been phenomenal football players. But to be honest with you, I meet some people that are like life coaches or, you know, inspirational speakers or, you know, followers that have been able to help tons of people. I would rather meet like Tony Robbins or different people like that, almost to me is good or better than meeting some of these superstars.
Yeah, I agree. You know, with my grandpa, especially he was a crazy drinker. He was a huge drinker. He was well known amongst the NFL as the biggest drinker during that time period.
Well, he had a couple other guys there too that I think were right with him.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
Max and Paul liked to get, you know, they were wild. And even in Paul's book, Golden Boy, there's like a 3-page spread on just a single day of drinking with my grandpa.
I heard those when I was younger, and I, you know what? That actually inspired me. I wanted to be like that, which is
absolutely crazy. And that was where I struggled as well, because that was what I thought, that was my legacy. I needed to drink heavy, be a good football player, and be like him. And I remember one night going out, and I was, you know, completely wasted, and I was with a guy, and I was telling him, and he looked me dead in the eye, and he was drunk as well, but he looked at me and he goes, "That's not your legacy." And I was like, "Okay, dude, no, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be awesome at it."
Yeah.
And he's like, "That's not your legacy. That's not who you need to be." He's like, "You think that that's cool. It's not the cool thing to do." And I was like, "Okay." And I remember thinking, what a jerk off. And I just,
yep,
you know, kept going on with my life. And it wasn't until like 5, 6, 7 years down the road. And it was like, I would just hear him say that in my head at random times. And I was like, man, you're right. That's not what it is. And that was I still think about that today. I can picture it as if it was yesterday. I know exactly where I was, who it was, where I was sitting, everything. But, you know, I think we think that that's what's normal, and we hunt for that warm feeling. And we just talked about, you know, my family, my wife, my kids, that's my warm feeling now. That's what makes me warm. Not the drinks, not the booze, not the beer. So, it's an incredible thing. It's so hard to do, but it's also, once you get there, you can kind of see where you should have been the whole time. I know from my personal experience as well, I was very vocal about my sobriety from the get-go. I got in a bad car accident on June 2nd, 4 years ago, and that was my rock bottom. And I literally woke up in my sister's basement, which was all cement. So there was my rock bottom, literally. And remember just thinking, I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. I don't know where I'm going to go from here. And I was going to lose my girlfriend, Amanda, my wife, you know, now, and Ethan. And so it was terrible. And that's when I changed. And I said, from that day, I said, I'm not drinking anymore. And it's almost 4 years now, and I haven't, but that's a huge commitment. And I made it vocal. I went on social media and I said, this is what I'm going to do. And I documented it. And would put a number as my status every month. And then eventually it became years. The greatest thing about it was having probably 5 to 10 different people contact me and ask me to help them in their, you know, their steps towards sobriety, which was extremely difficult for me because I had a different story and everyone always does. And so I was able, you know, I'm like, I don't have any secret potions. I don't have some magic trick I can give you that's going to help you. I'm like, I'm going to probably hand you a few cliches and it's just going to have to be your thing. You have to do it on your own. A lot of them didn't, but I have one especially who is now almost 2 years sober and we keep in contact. And like, for me, that's my win. That's my other win besides my family is being able to be a mentor and help this other person as much as I possibly can.
The cool thing that you just said, which I really admire, and I just met with a young man who I actually coached in high school, and he's 30 something now, and he came to me for some help. And one of the things that I think alcoholics or people that have issues with alcohol don't understand is what you just said. When I first got sober, previous to that, when people would, like, I had a couple of girls tell me I was a lush, and I didn't even know what that meant. I had to go look it up or ask somebody, and, you know, you find out that a lush is somebody who drinks differently, you know. And no one ever really came up to me and said they thought I was an alcoholic. They all said, you know, you got an issue, dude, and, you know, do you remember what you did last night, you know, all the blackout stuff.
Yeah.
And I always pictured in my head that I wasn't an alcoholic, because I always pictured an alcoholic as being the bum on the street that had the brown paper bag that was begging for money.
Yep.
The beautiful thing that I learned is, and this is what I helped this young man with, is that we get to choose our bottom. So your bottom for you chose it was when you had that car accident and we're in the basement. You know, other people can choose, all right, I went out and my wife got really mad at me and I need to make a change. Well, that's enough of a bottom. You don't need to go down to the bum street, living off the street level. You can make that choice. And I think the more people that can hear that can say, all right, I'm a fairly successful career person. I've got a wonderful family. I've got good kids. I'm a pretty decent father, but I got this issue with alcohol. When I go out, I can't stop. Well, you can choose that to be your bottom. Your bottom is that right there.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know what, on that particular day when you're out drinking, you're not a good father. And you want to be a good father all the time. You don't want your kid to hear you slur your words and act like an idiot ever. Yeah. Well, that's your bottom. And I think that if I could have, you know, maybe possibly if I could have heard that, and I don't know that I would have listened, but if I could have heard that, that would have been the seed, like your buddy that, or the guy that told you that, you know, he planted a seed in you.
Yep.
For you to start thinking about, okay, maybe that's not my legacy. You know, I had some similar seeds put into my head that Dave McLean had. He put a bunch of seeds in my head that I didn't even realize were there until I was, you know, in my 30s. I think that's the beautiful part about sobriety, or even you can say this, it's the beautiful part about addiction, is that you do have the ability to pick your bottom. And you can go and learn to not allow drugs or alcohol to control your life. It is possible. Millions of people do it. Not enough people do it, but there are plenty of people that do it. And as one person said, you know, if getting sober was something that was needed, we would have meetings in County Stadium. He said, but you know, we have meetings in church basements because it's only for people that want it. There's only a few people that want it. If there are, you know, many, many, many people need it, millions of people need it, but they don't choose to do it. And that's kind of the whole free will. You know, when you talk about spirituality and stuff, you know, we have that free will to decide. And you are one, and I am one that's very fortunate and blessed that we made that decision and we said, all right, I'm not going to allow something to control me anymore. And I don't. And that's more, I think that's almost not, I don't, I know it is. It's more powerful than saying I was an NFL football player.
For sure. People, your bottom doesn't have to be prison.
Right.
Your bottom doesn't have to be jail. Your bottom doesn't have to be a coffin. And that's a great, I've never really thought of that before, but it's true, because when people think, when you hear rock bottom, everyone thinks that's you're in jail or you're handcuffed up against the street, you know, like, no, that doesn't have to be that. It can be much better than that. I'm grateful that my bottom was the bottom of my sister's house. You know, cause I think if that would have never happened, there would be a different bottom, and it would be a lot deeper, because I think I allowed for my bottom to be so deep for some stupid reason. But it is, you know, it's an incredible thing. And I hope that more people are willing to take that step and understand that their value in life is so much more than what they probably put on it. You are coaching.
Yes. Still.
You are coaching for Arrowhead.
Correct.
Heck of a high school.
Awesome high school. Yes.
And you are also a life coach. Tell us a little bit how you, I mean, was that just a choice that you made, or did you have someone kind of guide you into it?
Well, when I was, so here's a little bit of that. So I was in education for about 22 years, and various different reasons I decided to get out. I also was going through a divorce, and in that process, I started to, you know, really take a hard look at my life and look at who I was. Like, you know, I'd been sober for quite a while, and here I was going through a divorce, and I felt, and I had made some horrible choices, and I had done some things that, you know, I would love to take back, and I was sober, you know, and when I say sober, it means I wasn't drinking or using drugs. I wasn't making good decisions. They were not sober decisions. And I'm at a bottom in my life again. And it's the same thing. Even though I wasn't drinking or doing drugs, I had a bottom where I had to choose, what am I going to do? And part of it was the career that I was in, I loved it for a long, long time, but it had taken its course. I mean, I was to the point where it was not fun anymore. It was not something that I was passionate about. And so I started searching, and a friend of mine told me about a woman who was a life coach, and I didn't want to go back to school at the age of 49 or whatever I was. I did not want to go back to school again to get a counseling license, because I really wanted to help others. That was my, that's my joy, is when I, when I'm able to do whatever I do to help others, that's awesome. So I met this woman and asked her to be my life coach, and she was, and I worked with her for a while and ended up getting certified as a life coach. And then I went into that full time thinking that that's what I was going to do. And I really, I enjoyed helping people, but there still was some pieces that were missing that I didn't, I wasn't feeling like this is going to be me full time and go. And at that time, as I said earlier in the podcast, my partner, Steve, and I were at our daughter's basketball training, where a woman named Mary Nellen, who runs a program called One-on-One Milwaukee, phenomenal training for girls in basketball, if you're ever looking. But we were watching it, and we just looked at each other and said, this would be pretty cool to do for kids, for football and for linemen. And so we decided a little less than 3 years ago to start a business and training and helping young offensive linemen and defensive linemen, number one, stay in the game. Number two, find out that it can be a really fun and life, you know, you can learn a lot of life lessons in the game. And so through that, I am still a life coach, and I still do meet with people. I just don't do it full time. I'm, you know, focusing on helping coach kids. I love the game. I think the game has changed a lot. You know, you look at the University of Wisconsin, they put out offensive linemen that go into the NFL every year. Many colleges, the NFL linemen that are going in are, you know, because of the spread offense in college, they don't have the skill set to play in the NFL, and it takes them a couple years to learn how to play that. The kids coming out of Wisconsin and Alabama and a few of these programs, they go into the NFL, they play right away. You know, you look at Ramchek down in New Orleans, he's doing phenomenal. You know, you look at Fredericks, all these guys, they're great linemen. Well, the reason they're great linemen is because they're learning at Wisconsin the correct way to play, and they're learning the correct skills. Steve and I want to do the same thing to help these young guys learn, because face it, how many youth coaches that are asked to be a coach really know how to coach? Very few. Yeah. And most of them know how to throw a football. Most of them know how to take a handoff and run through the hole. Very few of them know how to teach line skills. And so we really started to, you know, it was passionate to us to teach high school and youth coaches the correct way to do it so that the kids can learn the right way. And in our hopes is that more kids will stay in the game, because it is such a great game. You know, even with the concussion scare, it's still, you know, football is number four, and it's behind soccer, it's behind the hockey, and then number one is, believe it or not, riding a bicycle. Those are the one, you know, those three have more head traumas than football does up until the age of 18. Now, once you're in the NFL, it's a little different. But for any mom out there or dad out there, you don't need to be fearful of your kid playing football, because the reality of the situation is it's a lot safer than soccer, hockey, and riding a bicycle. So, and we try to teach a lot of skills that keep the head out of the game and that. So it's just been really, it's been really fun. It's a new passion for me. I think it's a needed passion, and I'm excited. I'm very excited about the future of our company.
Well, I think it's a cool thing that you're doing. I love it. I love the dedication to the offensive linemen. You don't see that. You've got 1,000 and 1,000,000 camps for quarterbacks and receivers and stuff like that. So I love it. I love seeing the big guys out there. You know, I think that's one of the most such an underrated situation with offensive linemen. People just don't give them the love that they deserve.
Here's the biggest thing too. I mean, when you're a kid, what do you want to do?
Play offensive line.
You want to touch the ball.
Yeah.
You know? So how do you tell a kid, hey, you know, it's going to be really fun to play O-line or D-line? No, it's not fun.
It's not. And I coached my son's team. I did flag football and then Pop Warner last year. I was not the head coach, but an assistant coach. And I was the new guy, and so I got put on offensive line, You know, they assume that since my grandpa played offensive line for the Packers that I know how to teach it. And it was I struggled trying to find something to get these kids to be like jacked up about it.
Right.
Because it is one of those, it's not the sexy position. You don't get any credit. You're the guy that nobody even sees because you're just there. You're a number. And it's really tough. So I remember it was, for me, it was the 61 championship ring that I have that my grandpa gave me. And so I wear that every single day. That is
that's so special.
My thing. It's motivation. Yeah. It's everything like that. That was my way of kind of showing them, you know, you can still be a star in a weird way. And I had them all get in a stance and I lined up against them and made sure that they could see it. And it was like, you can, you're still part of it. You're still going to get a ring. You're still going to be the man. You know, you can, if you do it right and you do it good, you can be just as good. And then the other thing that I told them was that, and this was a 2 years ago, was that really good offensive linemen make some of the biggest money in the NFL.
Yeah.
And they're like, really? And I was like, oh yeah, if you're a really good left tackle, you're going to make a lot of money. Like more than like receivers. And they're like, really? And I was like, oh, and then you start to see them like, all right, now they're getting, you know, a little amped up. And offensive linemen, and you know this more than anything, we're a different breed and there's different ways to get them going. And you can get them jacked up off the smallest things. And then it could take you an army to get them jacked up in the same breath. So I love that you're doing that. I love that you've been able to combine being a life coach and being a teacher with football. And you're kind of mixing all of your key traits, your key qualities together to become that kind of that superhuman, if you will. And I love that. I feel like, again, we are on a very same level here when it comes to what our goals are and what our legacy will be. You have your two daughters. I have my two sons. I think my goals in life are to be able to relate to people, talk to people, and coach in football. I love to coach football, and that's my plan. I will coach my boys up through college, I hope so. So, you know, it's really exciting to hear that. I love it. How's Arrowhead looking this year?
You know, Arrowhead is in a different they're in a different place than they're used to. You know, very similar to many programs. You can't stay at the top forever.
No.
You know, there's been some coaching changes there. The new guy, Coach Rauch, is doing, in my opinion, a very, very good job. You know, it's just times change and times are different. Arrowhead is a great school, has a lot of great kids in it. I think we're going to do very well still in football. I think we're going to compete. We don't have quite the talent that we've had in the past or the size, but we've got kids that want to play. They want to work hard. We've got coaches that work very hard. We've got, you know, Coach Rauch has done a great job of putting together his coaches that he wants, you know, to take the program. You know, it's going to take a little while. I don't, you know, you never know. I mean, we could be at the state championship this year. We may not even make it to the, you know, to there. You just, every year is different. I think, you know, you watch the Packers, you know, they've done phenomenal, but now all of a sudden they lose a little bit and they're kind of not what they used to be. Now everyone wants to just tear the whole thing apart and say, you know, we got to start over. It's a great game. It's a complicated game. You know, it takes special chemistry for a team to be together to go to the highest level. And that doesn't happen overnight. And whether people think it does or not, you know, you watch Alabama, Nick Saban, he does a phenomenal job. He's done it because he has his philosophy and the way he does it that is able to bring in these phenomenal players. Now you go with another philosophy, like when you watch Paul Christ, who is such a genuine guy, and who, when you meet him, I had the fortune to play with him and then also coach for his dad. You understand that he has the ability to make a kid feel like he's the most important kid in the world and that he belongs there. And so he takes a lot of kids that maybe weren't five-star chip or five, whatever they call that, five chip, whatever that is.
Five-star.
Yeah, five-star. And he'll take kids that have lower stars and make them better than the five stars because they believe in themselves, because they feel a part of. And I think that's kind of what, you know, I know that's what Coach Rauch is trying to do right now. And I believe he's headed in that direction. It just doesn't happen as fast as all the fans want it to happen. But it's I'm very, very grateful I'm coaching there, and I do enjoy being a part of that school. I've coached at Oconomowoc. I've coached at Kettle Moraine for many years. I coached at Muskego. So I've been around, and every one of those schools I love. I just love football. It doesn't matter where I'm at. I mean, you know, I'm always going to be a Badger. And yes. I'll always be a Cooney because I was at, you know, went to high school at Oconomowoc. But when it comes to coaching, I'm loyal to the kids. And that's the thing that I've learned too, you know, where I actually coach kids that play at Muskego and Waukesha South and Oconomowoc and all the different places who play against Arrowhead. You know, I'm the kind of guy who says, let's make everybody great and then the game will be greater. Let's not try and beat, you know, say, well, we got to do it this way because those guys, we can't have them a part of it. It's really cool. Our Play Big camp that comes up June 28th, we have Kevin Zeitler, who's the highest paid guard in the NFL, speaking of money and offensive. He makes a ton of money. He's our guest speaker, and he talks about it a lot. You know, it's finding guys to compete against. When you bring the best to compete against the best, you have a better product. You don't want to find weak guys. You don't want to find easy ways. You want to find, let's find out who's the best and let's go against them. Yeah, we may lose, but we're going to learn about it and then we're going to grow from it. And I think that's where it's been fun, because a lot of people say to me, well, you guys aren't going to state every, like, you know, state championship every. It's still the same game. And it's still trying to help kids get a chemistry, learn the techniques, learn the ability to play, and then go out and compete against the best. And the Classic 8 is a great conference for high school because, you know, you're playing against some of the best teams, Waukesha South and Waukesha West and all these schools that are CMH, Catholic Memorial. They're in the, you know, they go to the playoffs every year and go far into it. So Muskego does. It's just McGuanago, all of them. It's just a great, great, great time.
Yeah, and it's incredible. I love high school football. I've really been enjoying it. I went to Nina High School, played for Nina. My son is going to most likely be going to Appleton North. And it's been a transition because I'm Nina. I've always been Nina. And now I have to, like, buy Appleton North stuff.
Yeah.
It's definitely becoming one of those things, though. But I understand what you're saying with the kids, because and today's football compared to when I played is just incredibly different.
It is way
more advanced, way better. Yes. For instance, my son has strength and conditioning tonight for an hour.
Yep.
We never had that. We never for years. And the other thing is that he played Pop Warner and last year and the year before, and then it's all under the same regime, if you will. And so basically from fifth grade until his senior year, he'll be playing with the same type of playbook, same verbiage, same guys. And so that's incredible. And I never had the same coach. I never had the same playbook until we got to like my junior year, sophomore year or something. And he's going to have it all figured out by the time he's even in a freshman. And I think that's just awesome. I love that. It also creates such a brotherhood, which is my favorite thing about football. The guys that you will know the rest of your life and always have a relationship with. And then also his kind of acceptance, if you will, into the weight room. You know, I think a lot of kids can get scared about the weight room. And if you spend some time in there prior to the actual thing, then it kind of gets more exciting.
Yeah.
I love it. High school football is great. I love that you're coaching. Let us know one more time where we can find you, where your trench training is.
Yep.
All that good stuff.
Trenchtraining.com. So it's, you know, trench, T-R-E-N-C-H. One word, training, T-R-A-I-N-I-N-G.com. And our bio information there, our camp information, you know, my phone number's on there. You guys, you know, feel free to get a hold of me with anything that you got going on. Be happy to help. You know, it's just so fun to be a part of stuff like this. And I'm so grateful that you were able to hear my story and want to put it on your show. I'm just
absolutely
awesome.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on. We'd love to have you come on again, and we'll keep talking.
Maybe yeah, I'd be glad to. Yeah,
more of a routine thing, kind of help each other out. Maybe I'll need you once in a while just to kind
there
of
you go
step off my sure. chest. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it. We will make sure and kind of watch Arrowhead this year and make sure their offensive line play is up to par.
Yes.
If not, we'll give you some crap about it.
Give me it. Yeah, please.
Yeah, for sure. But thank you so much for coming on. And you guys make sure and check us out on Twitter at @thesweep_PTTF and on Facebook. Go up to that little search button, type in the sweep. We should be there. Or check us out at packtothefuture.com, our home base. And again, thank you, Glenn. And as always, go Pack Go.
Absolutely.